Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, talking bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day. This is the second part of episode 10, which was more about RuneQuest, and this has extra bits and pieces that didn't quite fit in it. It's a Wyrum's footnote, as we used to say back in the day, or a different world. Included in this part is the Games Master Screen section. Rick Mintz, the president of Chaosium, will face my table of treasures, my plunder table, to roll utterly and completely at random selections from his amassed collection and talk about his experiences back in the day. Rick made his name at Moon Design Publications, republishing Glorantha classics, and one of the volumes he reprinted was Borderlands, Chaosium's campaign supplement from 1982. Blythe joins me to open the box on the supplement, and we look back on how we played it back in 1983 and again 30 years later in 2013. The last section opens up the postbag that's arrived on Joe Myth's caravan, featuring listener feedback. Okay, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Games Master Screen.
Welcome to Games Master Screen. I will be putting up a Games Master Screen between me and President Rick Mintz, and I'll be rolling on this old school table to make five special selections from his famous collection. Hello there, Rick.
Hello, Dirk. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm actually using this Games Master Screen. This is one that I got with the RuneQuest Kickstarter. It's one of your pieces of work, this, I think.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, it's a tribute to the original Judges Guild, RuneQuest Judges Shield that they made many, many years ago when GM screens were a lot simpler and flimsier, but lots of great tables.
I never actually had a Games Master Screen, the Judges Guild one. I made my own from the tables that I pulled out of the middle of the rule book.
I know what to get you for the holidays then, because unfortunately the Judges Guild Judges Screen, it's very easy to find it still in the shrink wrap after 30 years.
That's true of a lot of Judges Guild.
Yes, sad but true. There's still a lot of Judges Guild product in the shrink, be it Duck Pond, Duck Tower, City of Lay Tabor, or any of the other things they did. Plus a lot of D&D stuff as well, but. I happen to have five of them still in the shrink, Dirk, so I'll try to send one your way.
Oh, that's great. Thank you very much. I actually transferred the City of Lay Tabor into Dragon Pass. So
interesting.
My Glorantha did vary back in the day.
No problem. We okay. know that's inevitable, and we actually, you know, enjoy that.
Okay, I'm going to roll on this table I've got here, Rick. And first up, I've got all the 88 Stormbringer.
Ooh. My Stormbringer experience started back in 1981 when the game came out. My GM, Tim Webster, brought home, or when I got to his house, he had all set to go a big box game called Stormbringer, which he had just purchased from Ryder's Hobby Shop in Kalamazoo. And so we started rolling up characters. And, you know, the one thing that some people may not remember about Stormbringer is that it was basically RuneQuest in the Young Kingdoms. It was the, you know, Michael Moorcock RuneQuest game. And it was very much an offshoot of RuneQuest. And so, yeah, we started rolling up characters that day. And I happened to get to – my background was from the Island of the Purple Towns.
Oh, brilliant. And did you play it often, then? Is this one of your core games?
We played it every week for several months. The problem at that time is it's almost an embarrassment of riches, is that in 1981, 82, Chaosium came out with so many amazing products that you always wanted to try the next one. And so, we had been playing RuneQuest for a while, the big box of, second edition RuneQuest. And, it's going to spill over to other items, so I don't want to give it away too much. When Stormbringer came out, we played it, but then other great stuff came out a few months later and wanted to try those as well. So we took a break and sometimes we didn't go back. But oh, Stormbringer was amazing. I was one of the agents and I was an elementalist of Strassa. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but I was always summoning water elementals, and I remember us trying to get demon armor and demon weapons. But my absolute favorite thing in the game was when, after getting very badly wounded, I got to roll on the table and I got impressive scar.
I'm surprised that you managed to keep a character for so long because I don't think I ever did. I think I used to have to roll a new character every week.
I guess I was lucky. I'm a real Munchkin power gamer. Back when, Munchkin was not a Steve Jackson card game, wonderful as it is, and I love playing that with the kids. But no, I loved rolling up characters that, could work every, plus and minus of the system and get every percentage out of things and, oh, I should go for con over dex or, things like that. And so, yeah, my one character managed to survive through the campaign before we kind of moved on to other games. But oh no, we had a Pantangian sorcerer and we had me from the Isle of Purple Towns and I was mainly a sailor and, I said, agent of Strassa, and I loved summoning water elementals. That was a big part of my character.
And were you a Moorcock fan at this point?
I had read a couple of the Stormbringer books, which is why I was very interested in playing the game, but this made me want to read them all because one of the things that Chaosium was very good at doing was giving you in the back of their books a list of, potential reading material. And that included a list of the books for Stormbringer. And so I was like, I haven't read this one and that one. And so, started grabbing the other ones that I hadn't read and read through the whole series because of that, after seeing what was in the appendixes.
The most striking thing I think of that early edition of Stormbringer is the cover. It's just so impressive, isn't it? It's one of the best, I think.
Oh yeah, Frank Brunner did a wonderful job on all the art in there. To me, the cover is awesome, no doubt about it, especially on the box set. But it's the one of Grome, with the
Yes.
holding, with the trees and the ship and all that. That is such an evocative picture. So I love the Brunner art throughout that whole book.
So the edition you've got, is that a mint edition? So what did you get in that?
Yes.
What did you get in that first box then? Because we had the narrow one, the thinner box.
Sure, the big box. I mean, one of the nice things is that Chaosium has always included in their box sets, especially in the Golden Age, that nice sheet of paper of what's in the box. And so, yeah, I'm looking through the box right now. It has, cardboard cutouts of monsters and characters. It has, the Perfect Bound Stormbringer book. It has character sheets. It has dice. It's got a nice map of the Young Kingdoms, and I always loved Uruk-Chodok's maps in the
Yes.
Chaosium box sets. And so, love that map. I know because I was from the Island of Purple Towns, I always wanted to sail around and go to other places, especially places in the books that I, read about but had never been to. In my box, and this is one of the things I love about the big boxes, is I've got a lot of these Stormbringer supplements. I got the Stormbringer Companion. I got the White Wolf book, with the Temples, Demons, and Ships of War. I got Ken Rolston's, Black Sword scenario, Pursuit of the White Wolf, and I got the second Stormbringer Companion, Demon Magic, and they all fit in the box, which is wonderful.
Bring
But
back the
those.
boxes. Bring back the boxes, I say.
I love boxes, but they are one of the worst things to ship and not have them get damaged. It's the most common thing that gets damaged. Like, I love the slip case that was done for the 7th edition, Call of Cthulhu, but it's the most commonly damaged thing in the whole thing. And like Horror on the Orient Express, you know, it that almost, you know, made them double print, you know, especially like just a quick digression story. When Chaosium did the first Horror on the Orient Express, they had it in almost like this cigarette packet, very thin, flexi cardboard, cardstock type of packet, you know, almost like a big tuck box for cards. And it actually bankrupted the printer that did that.
Really?
Because they had so much damage just putting the books inside of that, because they there was not an extra millimeter or, you know, spare, you know, 18th of an inch of space, where they were damaging half of the boxes just putting the product into it. And then, of course, when they arrived at various distributors and everything else, there was a lot of damage. I think they had to do, I don't know how many multiple print runs of boxes just to box that product. And the anecdotal story I heard from Greg is that it put that printer out of business.
Wow. See, I always loved the box. In the UK, Games Workshop moved away from boxes. And I always used to think that it was down to the fact that there's no VAT on books over in the UK.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's a huge thing. I mean, I know that it caused a major backlash for RuneQuest 3 when it came out in the UK, is that the VAT on that boxed edition made it just unaffordable. It was expensive anyway, but just, you know, now England has 20% VAT on stuff. It was, I think, about like 15 or 17% back then, but still throwing that kind of sales tax on top of it just made it almost unaffordable. I've heard that story so many times about people said, I didn't get third edition because of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got your Stormbringer box there. Now, I would be failing as a podcaster if I didn't ask you, what are the chances of seeing a Kickstarter in the future to bring Stormbringer back to life, back into print?
It's not impossible. It's just, I mean, we have, you know, obviously all the files from all the classic Stormbringer material. It's just a matter of, we don't have the license with Michael Moorcock right now.
But is that something you're working on?
I'll just say that it's not impossible that'll happen.
Right.
It's not anytime super soon.
Right. Well, we'll leave it there.
I will say this though.
Yeah.
I've always had a personal desire to see Stormbringer in print again.
Well, that is exciting. That's exciting. Perhaps if together we can summon Ariok, we can make this happen.
I like your style. I like your style, Burke.
Okay, let's go back to the table.
All right.
23. And this is...
Ooh, that's an impressive scar, by the way.
That's Griffin Mountain. Griffin Ooh. Mountain.
This is one of my all-time favorites. This is really the biggest and longest RuneQuest campaign back in the day that I played in. And because I was a player, I can't verify it, but I think we played every page of that wonderful Perfect Mountain book.
How did you get into the adventure? What was your character?
I played Belazering from one of the Citadels. I'm trying to remember exactly which one. You'd think I'd know. It certainly wasn't Elkoi, and it wasn't Daikin. It must have been Trillis. That was our first trip we're just outside of Trillis. That was our first big trip to the big city. And I remember that's where we met Joe Myth, who hired us to be on his caravan.
What adventures did you go on? I believe that I remember you telling me in some email correspondence that you encountered Gonarta.
Oh, yes. I mean, we made the three Citadel tour, because that's just the big thing to do. Yeah. And then we headed up into the wilds on his caravan with, you know, him and Zigzag the Troll and his wife and such. We were the caravan guards, or at least part of the caravan guards. We met Gondol Holst along the way and a few other classic encounters. And then we headed up to Giant Land into the mountains, and we ended up in Gon Orta's castle, where I got to roll the people-sized dice down the hill and won. You know, he did pick us up, and we were told that he was looking for ducks. and it was a wonderful time there. That's where I met Mr. Greatness, the Morricanth, who actually has a Morricanth thumb. And so, oh yeah, no, it's a wonderful set. You know, it's also got one of my favorite maps in it. And so I'm pulling the map out of the, well, it's already detached in the book I have here. So I'm taking the map out and having another look at it again, just to bring back some memories here. But oh yeah, we went all over this map up into the 11 big giant mountains. I'm actually looking at the Games Workshop version of this particular book, you know, the one with the rolling die on the cover.
Yeah, that's the one we had here.
Yeah, in the wonderful A4 format, the taller and the slightly skinnier paper size. But yeah, unfortunately, you know, the one thing is the Games Workshop version has a smaller printed map.
Ah, right. So
it's not as big a sheet of paper. Right, quite
got,
a bit.
I've got my copy here, actually. Unlike yours, mine's held together by sellotape, and the pages are falling out. So,
well, you know, the one that took all the beating in our campaign was owned by Tim, our game master. So this is a copy I picked up after the fact. I picked up one when I was in the UK. I didn't even know the UK had done editions of various RuneQuest, you know, and other Chaosium publications until I got over there in the 90s. I was woefully ignorant of all the licensees who did wonderful editions of the Chaosium products.
And you've got a collection of the Citadel miniatures as well, haven't you?
Oh, I love the Citadel miniatures. All things Game Workshop, especially the Citadel minis. Turning around and looking over at the shelf behind me here, you know, I got all sets 1 through 7 and all the variants, you know, about 20, 25 boxes of them sitting on the shelf, along with a couple of cases of the painted ones. I'm a lousy painter myself, never really got into that. But, you know, over in the UK, I met a guy named Jim, wonderful miniatures painter, and he was happy to paint up my collection of all the Citadel box sets. So I just try not to let my kids around them too much, because they are, every one of them's all lead.
And so as a collector, I'm sure you've sought out some of the specials that were done as well. They did some for the some of the shops opening in the UK.
Oh yeah, the Samurai Duck, or the, I think it's the Manchester special, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I got one of those in the baggie, and I got one of those painted up. And then there's also the Rabbit Brew that was done.
Oh, I've not seen that one.
Yeah, it's a modification of an assassin figure they did. But yeah, the tracking down Games Workshop special editions and Citadel minis variants and things like that, that's a real art in itself. And I have a few collector acquaintances and friends who, you know, have all kinds of things that were very, very super limited editions. But I mainly just have all the core Citadel RuneQuest stuff.
Well, our route into Griffin Mountain was via Borderlands, so we actually did the final trip up the River of Cradles and got into Griffin Mountain that way.
Yeah, no, I wish I could have done that. It's funny, because we played Griffin Mountain when it came out in 81, and then, of course, Borderlands came out after that, so we really didn't have the option of doing it in the order that Borderlands suggests. But I know when we did the Glorantha Classics, we definitely set it up where, you know, you could do it with a lot of gusto and do all of Borderlands and then switch right over to Griffin Mountain.
Great. And have you been through the Borderlands campaign? Did you go through it back in the day?
We played a bit of it, but just a couple of scenarios, because we weren't new characters by then. And, you know, a lot of Borderlands, one of the beauties of it is it introduces new characters, like a lot of the supplements did for RuneQuest. And so, because we had already, you know, I was a Isseries rune priest by then. I wasn't a beginning character, so some of the early scenarios didn't really make a lot of sense for us. So we just mainly headed down toward Pavis and wanted to explore the Big Rubble and did a few Borderlands encounters and adventures along the way.
I think what it's showing that, Rick, is that you're definitely more of a power gamer than we were, because we just went through characters like, you know, I never got to Rune Lord level or Rune Priest level. I think we were just too brutal with each other.
I guess, you know, a lot of GMs, they maybe are less hesitant or more hesitant to kill off characters Certainly several people died in a lot of my campaigns. I know I went through D&D characters when I was playing D&D like water. A lot of those died, but I was one of these people that didn't want to die. So yeah, my character, he was still alive by the time I stopped playing RuneQuest back in the day.
And who knew, as back in the day playing an Isaris rune priest, that now you would be heading a company like Chaosium as
Hey, you know, just I like to just believe some things were meant to be.
meant to be, exactly.
And so I got to play all the Chaosium big boxes when they came out. I got to be there, starting in the late 70s all the way up through all the wonderful things they released. And it was just a wonderful time to be a gamer, especially as a kid, where you had a lot of free time all summer long with the wonderfully long summer vacations we have in the United States, from middle of June all the way through till September. A lot of good gaming time to get in there. And I also did a lot of gaming on my Boy Scout trips, especially if we had a long bus journey somewhere. We were always gaming, while we were watching the miles roll by.
Well, let's go back to the table. And next up, it's 66, it's Traveller.
Ooh. Yep, not everything I play is all about Chaosium games. And, Chaosium didn't do a lot with science fiction in particular. But even before I started playing some of the Chaosium games, I managed, this is something I bought myself, was the small black box of Traveller with the initial books in it. And so I unfortunately lost that box. It's one of the few things in my game collection that I didn't manage to hold on to. I always tried to take good care of my toys, so to speak. But the Traveller box, somewhere along the way, it did not survive. But still got the books that came in the box. And, the one thing about Traveller I never realized at the time is that you're basically paying a pensioner. Or we say retiree in the States, but it never really sank in that I was happily rolling up some creaky old geezer who was 60, 65, whatever it took, whatever number of rolls it took until you got a scout ship.
Yeah, well, as a power gamer, you'll have been pushing the terms in the military as far as you could. So.
Oh yeah, no, we always had maximum seniority to get my mech tech elec skills up, as I used to call it.
Is this a game again where you were mainly the player or as a referee?
I was just a player in this one as well. I've only refereed a few specific things, but especially back in the day, I always wanted to play. I always wanted to get my characters, better weapons. Always very much into getting all kinds of cool loot, and so with Traveller, it was always getting a bigger and better ship. Back in the day when they measured computers and the number of tons that they took up and stuff like that. I always, one of the big things is our group, we were always trying to get bigger and better ships. And for a while it was like, hey, let's, especially when the books related to building ships came out, it was, hey, let's hollow out an asteroid and have basically, our miniature version of the Death Star. And so it was always getting a bigger ship and then basically being pirates to attack somebody else and steal their bigger ship from them.
And did you play many of the published scenarios or adventures, or were they ones that were written by your referee?
We played one. It was actually the Judges Guild marooned on Ghost String, I think it was. But that was mainly homebrewed stuff. I played a lot of Traveller with my Boy Scout buddies because it was really good for pickup games. And so we usually played a lot of whatever people thought of at the time.
And does your collection extend to getting more Traveller stuff? So, for example, have you got the Citadel miniatures for Traveller?
I don't have any of the miniatures for Traveller, but I do have a pretty close to complete set of the little black books, plus all of the wonderful reprints done by the Far Future Enterprises.
Oh,
You know,
yeah.
they did the omnibus books. So I've got all those, but those are just some recent acquisition. They were half off at a bookstore, so I bought a bunch of them. But the little black books, I kept getting them as they came out, and I got a lot of them when I was over in the UK. It was I un unfortunately a lot of my friends or friends of friends especially up at Convulsion, they would be getting out of gaming or wanting to thin all the games they were no longer playing and sell them to other people at the bring and buy at Convulsion. And you could pick up stacks of stuff for not so much money. And I was always happy to round out my collection of this or that, especially at Convulsion.
Well, let's go back to the table. And next up, it's 70, and it's the Dungeon Master's Guide.
Ooh, yeah, this is one of the first things I ever bought for role-playing, and I'm taking off the shelf my 1978 Dungeon Master's Guide. I think it's the second printing, but I'm not positive. Certainly well-loved and well-used, but this is really the first big book. This was, the biggest role-playing game book I can think of from that era. You're talking several hundred pages. And this is where I spent a lot of time prepping adventures and creating characters, but I was in a campaign playing as a player. But I definitely owned this one. And, this is what really set the hook deep. This was one of the first things this was before I was into RuneQuest.
Really? Because we pose a question in our podcast about Dungeon Master's Guide or D&D. Do you think that power gamers are drawn towards D&D, or does D&D make power gamers?
Well, obviously, you either got a power gamer inside of you or not, and I think D&D just gives you a way to express it. Some of the things, especially all the treasure tables, and then the artifacts, which are true power gamer constructs, unique, super powerful items, they were almost irresistible.
It's all about the numbers.
A lot of it. You certainly get very hooked on getting experience points and how much gold you got. And don't get me wrong, I loved it to death. I can remember when I got my first Vorpal sword. I can remember, especially because Star Wars was big at the time. I kept begging my dungeon master Brian to let me come up with some type of Vorpal sword that was basically a lightsaber. And I was willing to pay any amount of money to have one crafted for me. And eventually he relented, and my paladin had basically a lightsaber Vorpal weapon. This was, when the monochrome series of Against the Giants came out, the Steading of the Hill Giant Chief, and the Glacial Rift of the Frost Giant, and the Hall of the Fire Giant King. And so, yep, my collection of characters and the other guys in the campaign, we basically went after giants, and one by one, looted every one of those places.
Great fun.
Although with the hill giant, I remember that, this big wooden fortress that it starts out with, we ended up burning that down. So we mainly had to fight all in the dungeons underneath.
Okay, let's have a final roll. I'll make it a big one. Let's 91, it's,
ooh,
it's Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah. This is what stopped us from playing a lot of Stormbringer, because Call of Cthulhu came out in the same year that Stormbringer did. And this, once again, it was set up as, a RuneQuest derivative. A lot of people think of Chaosium as, basic role-playing is their big generic system. But there was no such thing as basic role-playing as its own game for a long time in Chaosium's history. Really, that came out in the 90s. They did have a very slim 16-page introduction to role-playing that was called basic role-playing. But it really wasn't a game. It was really just, a few pages of, here are some basic things you'll find in all our games, and here's what it's about, playing in a role-playing game. It was not meant to be its own rule book or anything. It was really, in some ways, the kind of thing you could hand to your parents and say, this is what this satanic stuff is really all about. It's not about being a witch or summoning things in real life or anything like that, with the whole mazes and monsters craze that swept the United States. It was really just an easy way of saying, this is what you do in role-playing games. And Call of Cthulhu and Stormbringer, when they were first being developed by Chaosium, they were both just RuneQuest in a different setting. Not to make light of it, but Stormbringer's kind of a RuneQuest in the Young Kingdoms, And Call of Cthulhu originally was set up as RuneQuest in a horror setting, in this case, the 1920s.
When I started playing Call of Cthulhu, I had no idea who H.P. Lovecraft was.
Me either. No clue. I know our GM, Tim, he was a pretty well-read guy, and he had read some H.P. Lovecraft, some of the classic, Color Out of Space and The Call of Cthulhu and things like that, but I'd never heard of anything like that at all. In some ways, Chaosium is largely credited with bringing H.P. Lovecraft back out of obscurity and into the common mainstream with the Call of Cthulhu game.
So it must feel a great sense of responsibility because of all the brands that Chaos seems responsible for. This is the one, isn't it? This is the
It's
big
the
global.
biggest. It's the big global one, and it's an incredibly popular genre. I enjoyed playing Call of Cthulhu when it came out. We only played it for a little while just because other things kept coming out by Chaosium. It wasn't long after that, Ringworld came out, Pendragon came out. It was you there was always so much new to try. It was hard to stay focused to just any one game, especially if you like trying different games, But I loved my gangster with his Thompson submachine gun with a whole big 50-round drum of silver bullets in case we met anything undeady lycanthropy type of stuff. Once again, big power gamer. Nothing says power gamer more than a Thompson submachine gun.
So when did you first encounter Sandy?
I believe I met Sandy Peterson at RuneQuest Con 1 in Baltimore. That's right. I know I met Greg there for the first time, and I'm pretty sure I met Sandy there. It's hard to believe that RuneQuest Con 1 was 30 plus years ago. I'm sorry, 20 plus years ago in 94. Gotta watch my math skills here. You'd think as a power gamer my math would be better. But yeah, it was over 20 years ago, and I met a lot of people that weekend. The one of the dots from Avalon Hill was there, and I made the mistake of complaining about his game without knowing who he was. He was handing out errata sheets for RuneQuest 3, and this little errata sheet, and I made some comment about I wish they would have gotten their act together and actually put it in the game. I don't know what kind of clowns they got running Avalon Hill. He just kind of he's like. That's me.
Brilliant.
That was the younger of the two dots. That was Baby Dot, not Papa Dot. But with Call of Cthulhu, yeah, it's a big brand. It's way beyond just the Call of Cthulhu game. You see Cthulhu references. Name the popular social media or television shows or movies or a lot of things. It's definitely a part of common culture today. It's way beyond Call of Cthulhu, the role-playing game, but Call of Cthulhu is really what I think really got the whole bandwagon underway.
It's kind of similar, isn't it, with because Cthulhu and H.P. Lovecraft, in the same sense of Glorantha as well. There's kind of been a proliferation of rules and systems around around the setting. Do you think that how does that make it difficult for a games company to kind of position themselves?
Well, I mean, the reason we did 13th Age, as well as, of course, the RuneQuest rules and HeroQuest, part of it's just historical, pull with, Greg always wanted to do a high level, epic version of RuneQuest, but he couldn't find a way to make percentile numbers work when you're talking not 100% skill or 300% skill or 500% skill. The numbers just don't really work that well. So we came up with a new rule system that portrayed higher level stuff all the way up to God level, with the mastery levels. And, we want people to be able to experience the world of Glorantha with that type of rules. And then, of course, we obviously want to support RuneQuest and its approach with the percentile based and, the stats and all that. That's a very known quantity. Although we are in the new edition of RuneQuest, bringing out a lot more of the runes and how they relate to developing your character, empowering your character, and possibly limiting your character. And then with 13th Age, the big the big behemoth in role-playing games is the D&D rule system. It's got a number of varieties between Pathfinder and the latest fifth edition of D&D and so on. And we wanted to appeal, because a lot of people are like, well, I don't mind Glorantha, but I like playing D&D with those rules. Why do I have to learn a whole new set of rules if I want to play, in Glorantha? And so we wanted to give people a bridge to Glorantha through a D&D friendly type of rule set like 13th Age.
So, but with the Cthulhu, it's different, isn't it? Because obviously, with those systems, in some extent, they were within your gift, aren't they? But there is a proliferation of
Oh, yeah.
Cthulhu material, whether it's board games or things. So, how's it changed to make Call of Cthulhu distinctive amongst those?
Well, it's obviously has a wonderful 35-year publication history. And, we're currently up to product numbers in the 140s. So you're talking, 100, almost 150 products that relate to it. So if you want to do role playing and you certainly are willing to get supplements that were written a number of years ago, a lot of them are available as PDF, of course, since PDFs never go out of print. But it's not too hard to get a lot of the older supplements still printed, between eBay and other various online retailers and all that. Plus, we sell a fair bit of the back catalog and want to get some more of that back into print through print on demand. But it's just such a vast catalog to go through. And in the end, to me, whether a company is successful with Cthulhu or not is not because it has the name Cthulhu on it, but because it's got awesome writing that's just a real pleasure to read. And you think of iconic names like Sandy Peterson and what he's written. You think of Keith Herber and other people like that, all the way up through the current crop of writers, Mike Mason and the people that work with him, Paul Fricker, and I hate to not mention certain names, so I'm not trying to omit anybody's name on purpose, but it's those, Mark Morrison in Australia. They write such fantastic stuff, and one of the great things is a lot of those guys got their start with Call of Cthulhu RPG writing, and they still want to write for kind of the granddaddy of them all. And that's what makes a quote unquote Cthulhu author kind of earn some of their street cred is they've written something for Chaosium. And so we really take the great writing seriously, and we wanted to combine that with great presentation and great layout as well, which is one of the things that Chaosium was kind of falling behind the curve on.
And have you ever played with Sandy, Call
Yes,
of
I
Cthulhu?
have. I got to play with Sandy out at EternalCon. It was called Tentacles at the time. It's been a convention that's been around since the 90s. And, every year in a wonderful youth hostel in a medieval castle on the Rhine, a lot of us would gather, about 100, 150 of us. And Sandy's a regular attendee. And I got to play in one of his Call of Cthulhu campaigns up in the big castle tower. A lot of steps, but well worth the climb. And I had that classic Call of Cthulhu experience with Sandy of I went nuts and then I got eaten.
Brilliant.
You got a twofer on that one. And that's any game that you can play where people are, excited and happy and walk away feeling good about I went nuts and then I got eaten as the end result. That's a pretty good role-playing game, if you ask me.
I could roll on this table all day, Rick, because you've got such a fantastic collection.
Well, thank you.
I just need to say that before you go, I believe that we share a talent that I would love to test one day. It's a gift from Humact, or something I've been working on. The ability to be able to get the alcohol content of beer just by tasting. Is this true?
At the Kraken this year, yes, they that kind of just happened, didn't really plan anything like that, but one of the great things about European conventions is usually there's a plentiful supply of various beverages, including beer. And my good friend Fabian, who I met back in 1995, he was running Tentacles, and then after that he then he and his crew of convention organizers started doing the Kraken, which is a wonderful convention. Yeah, that's where, just through casual conversation, they started asking me, so how strong do you think this beer is? And I said, oh, it's probably about 5.5%. And lo and behold, it was 5.5%. I did a lot of home brewing.
Yeah, it takes a lot of practice, doesn't it? But, you know, once you've got the gift, it never leaves you. So maybe one day we'll meet in a grog shop and have a gut rock challenge.
I would love that. Look forward to it, Dirk. It'll be a wonderful part of the whole experience.
Well, can I just say thank you for doing this, Rick? And just as well to say thank you for your part in saving Chaosium, because I think I'm speaking on behalf of gamers everywhere. From chaos springs great things, and thank you for your hero quest in actually saving this great company.
Well, I'm very happy to have played my part, and thank you for that compliment. As Mob and Jeff and Neil and I have all said in a couple of seminars and such, when it comes to about Chaosium and how things changed and how we were happy to step in and do our part, you know, we grew up with Chaosium since we were kids. It's been a part of our lives for 30 plus years, you know, 35 years or more even. And we hate to see something that iconic and so wonderful and quirky and frustrating and lovable and everything else. We didn't want to see it die. And fortunately, we were in a position in our lives where, as I said, some things were just seemed to be meant to be. And us getting involved in Chaosium, you know, it was very quick and sudden at the time, but in some ways it had been one of those things that had been slowly percolating and building up to for many, many years. And we hope it continues on for many, many more years to come, long beyond our involvement in the company. But no, very happy to have played our part in helping get things back on track and where we are today.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks, Dirk. All the best.
All the best. Thank you.
Open box.
Welcome to Open Box. I'm with Blythe. Hello, Blythe.
Hello, Dirk.
So this is the point where we go back in time to when we first encountered a game and bring ourselves up to date to the present day and reflect on our feelings and thoughts on that. It's nostalgia, but with a longing for the future, Blythe.
I think you're right, yes.
It's forward-backwards thinking.
Forward-backwards thinking.
Yeah.
You're very good at that. I've made a career out of it, to be honest, some people would say.
We can see where we're went in from as well as coming against.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think you get the idea. Okay. Yeah. And this time, we're opening a box. I'm going to call it, because this is what you find with Moon Design. Moon Design used this expression. I'm going to call this a foundational document. A foundational box.
Foundational document. What does that mean?
And it means the foundations upon which we build... Okay. Our role-playing experiences.
Oh yeah, well yeah, that's true. For this in particular, yeah. more than any other in some respects. Yeah. Games aside, obviously.
Yeah, so this is Borderlands, a campaign supplement that was originally produced in the box by Chaosium back in the day, 1982. It's in a real box, and it's the first in a sequence of great campaign sets: Griffin Mountain, Big Rubble, Pavis, and Troll Pack. And for us, it was a big event. I got it for Christmas, I think,
yes,
in that year.
Yeah.
And I remember being very excited about it, because I think I got Cults of Prax at the same time. And prior to that, we'd just been making it up, hadn't we? We'd kind of had the rule book and didn't have anything else.
Yeah, well, we'd done Grindel's Pawn Shop, and then you'd gone on a kind of weird riff of your own invention. we're just making stuff up. So it had all been kind of made up, what people would call homebrew stuff now. We didn't call it that then.
No, just making
stuff up. And this was the first proper campaign. And I think it's fair to say, for you particularly, but also for me, it tied into that notion of playing it properly, doing it properly. And this was in here. Although we'd done Grindel's Pawn Shop, that's... even when we were new to it, felt very introductory, because it is very introductory.
Yeah.
But this felt like a proper big grown-up campaign, and inside the box of Borderlands would be all the secrets of how to really play it in Grolantha. And
it's one of those things where, as a child, and I do it now, It built up in my imagination as some kind of grand epic scale.
It is, but yeah.
And in order to fulfil that, when I got it that Christmas, I think normally we would role play in my bedroom or your bedroom.
Mm.
And I think we actually upgraded to the dining room table.
We did. I have a vivid memory of sitting around your dining room table for this one. So it required that. It was like the Queen or the local mayor had come for tea. Yeah. So we had the best crockery.
I do think I put the tablecloth.
I think you might have done, yeah. That didn't work particularly well. But. Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was like a dignitary. It was come for tea. Dirk's house.
It was such a major event, just getting ready to do this, and I'd build it up in your imaginations, and we spent time making the characters, and I suppose we'll come on to that.
And I think as well, what was very telling about Borderlands, and this was true of a lot of KSEM stuff, when we'd go to Games Workshop, you had all the modules for D&D, didn't you? You know, the modules for D&D. And you had the little books for Traveller, and they all looked, whilst the content, well, not in the case of Traveller, content were rubbish, but in the contents of a D&D module, you know, as we later find out, were fine. There were good, some good modules and good adventures, nothing wrong with the content, but they didn't look as good as KSEM stuff, because it came in a box. And when you open this, you know, you get all the booklets and the map. And it just looks fantastic. The whole feel of it looks good.
And on the back of in the back of White Dwarf and the reviews, it looked great, didn't it? With that cover with the barbarians coming over.
Yeah, the front cover. Because that's the thing, isn't it? The modules, the D&D modules, would I mean, Traveller ones are just black plain covers are boring. And the D&D modules had some crappy illustrations. They had a reputation, didn't they? TSR sort of a really naff picture of a beholder on the front of a module. That looked like a, I don't know, like a Christmas pudding with tentacles.
But this...
you know, the terrible Christmas pudding monster. What's this? A Christmas... The new monster? No, it's a beholder. Oh, right. It looked like that.
So let's have a look inside the box then, because the contents were great. I mean, the great supplements should unlock the imagination, and I think it's fair to say that that's what this does. So inside there's the referee's handbook, which is the red document that had background. That's the background of the campaign. Some of the races that you encounter.
A bit more detail on like Morakanth and some of the other tribes and what have you.
So it's set in Prax, isn't it? So it's in the on the River of Cradles, right at the southern tip of the River of Cradles, where the adventures take place. And it's at a point of time where the barbarians have been pushed back, haven't they?
Yes.
And there's a bit of jockeying for position. And in this area, it's been bequeathed to a lunar general,
noble,
former soldier, and he's been put in exile, and he's been given this land to kind of tame and create settlements for lunar people to move down the river and settle there in the other stages. And the referee's handbook kind of gives you some flavour of the races, and I think it's got some extra cults in there, hasn't it? Like the Zolafel and...
There's a bit of it, but there's a seahorse cult or something, which is, I think, the Newtlins cult.
There's also the Green Encounter Book, which we'll go in a bit more detail, but, you know, this is one of my catchphrases. The best thing about RuneQuest is that the NPCs are as fully fleshed out as the PCs, but the worst thing about RuneQuest is that the NPCs as fully fleshed out as the people.
You get, that's the problem, I think, with it. Yeah, you're right there. Because the encounter book, I mean, we're going to discuss it at length, but I would say the encounter book is really the crowning glory of Borderlands, weirdly, because it moves away from the idea of wandering monsters. So the idea that you just roll an encounter book, or you encounter some bandits, or you encounter some this or some that. Because what it does, it gives you the background of all the encounters. It gives you the motivations, doesn't it? It gives you who they're allied to, who they don't like, what's going on between. So there's, for example, you'll meet a tribe of... I mean, I think the best example is there's a tribe of, or a group of... Oh, is it Impala Riders? and they're a bit of a pain in the neck, and they're kind of young bucks who wind you up, and the idea is that, you know, they get on your nerves a bit. And one of them is a chieftain's daughter, so the difficulty is you might end up fighting them, but one of them a chieftain's daughter, and of course you did, didn't you?
Ended
up killing the chieftain's daughter. Oh dear,
it was an accident.
It was a terrible accident. Yeah. But it's got that thing where it's not just a bunch of bandits, it's people who have connections in the land, motivations, and actually from some of the encounters you can build little mini adventures almost.
Yeah. And what, perhaps going to that, I mean, for this 12-year-old opening it in back in the day, 1982, Christmas 1982, the best thing about it was that it just had stats blocks. So it meant that I didn't have to roll any characters. Yeah. So that was the main
thing. And a nice map.
And a great nice map. Yeah. So I should say about the map as well that, you know, it's one of KSEM's full light maps.
Yeah.
It looks great on your dining room table.
It does. that's why I did it on the dining room table, so I can fold the map out.
And it shows this region, which is like a steppe region, isn't it? In the river valley with plateaus and... It's kind of a monument valley type.
Got that feel to it.
And then there's the crux of the box, which is the seven scenarios, which are presented as like pamphlets, and they're numbered 1 to 7. And the intention, I think, is for you to do them sequentially.
Yes.
Well,
I think that's very much the intention, because they are. I mean, we might talk about the difficulty of Borderlands. In terms of character's progression later, but they sort of progress in that way, don't they? So they get progressively
More difficult. Yes.
Yeah.
So. I think it's fair to say that there is a significant leap. So I think it starts off fairly gently, and then
it does actually. Yeah, but there is also a timeline of events as well. So. The scenarios happen in time, don't they? So
yes.
It's not like there's seven things that you can visit and do in any order the players want. They are timelined in, aren't they?
Yeah.
So one thing will happen, then another thing will happen.
So in order to tame the land, to achieve what he wants, Ross of Rohan goes out to seek mercenaries. And player characters play mercenaries who are under the watchful eye of Dane.
Yeah.
He's a sergeant at arms, a Humact warrior who kind of looks after him. And they have to sign a punitive contract.
It's a contractual, isn't it?
An A4 sheet of legalese that you have to sign.
And it is quite a tricky contract, isn't it? It doesn't give you a lot, does it? I remember at the time, it's almost like the biggest stumbling block is getting your players to sign this contract. Because when they read it, they get like, you know, 10 lunars a week pay. Ten lunars a week paid in cash. And a fair share of any loot received according to the normal conventions. But then some of the conventions are that anything you find, the Duke gets sort of 90% of it, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So if you go out and kill a load of brew and find a load of treasure, legally... You have to give it to the Duke, don't you? Because it's on his land.
It's like
leaves you with sod all.
It's like one of those contracts that bands signed up for in the 60s and 70s, isn't it?
It is, actually. Yeah, it is very much, isn't it?
You're only
great, I've found a magic... I've killed these brew, but I've found a magic sword. Brilliant. Oh, you're going to give that to the Duke.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Does he... Could he... Well, he'll give you 10% back, but he can't give you 10% of a sword, can he? So here's a bag of 50 lunars. Now off you go.
Yeah. And... you've got food and lodging. What more do you want?
What more do you want? You've got a hotel room to throw a TV out the window of. Like a rock band.
So let's talk through these adventures then. So I suppose we should give out the usual spoiler alert. But I suppose if you got this far, you know that we're going to spoil that.
Yeah, it's difficult to talk about it without giving away some of the secrets. So if you're thinking of playing Borderlands,
look away now.
Look away now. Stop put cotton wool in your ears.
Yeah.
Or maybe even just switch off the podcast. Maybe easier option, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Switch off the podcast.
Yeah, switch it off now. Zub it on a bit. So, It starts off with Scouting the Land, and this is a kind of overture, really, isn't it? It gives the mercenaries an opportunity to move around the place, to go around the map and tour the Duke's lands and encounter some of the barbarian tribes that inhabit the thing. We should perhaps talk about Morrocan, shouldn't we? Because this is where you really get introduced to Morrocan, because in the second edition rules, you only get like a paragraph describing who the Morrocanth are, but there's much more to it. To me, Morrocanth are the embodiment of what makes Glorantha interesting.
Yes, yeah, because, they're kind of like tapir type, bear tapir type creatures, aren't they? Kind of upright, intelligent, can speak, and what have you. But the unusual thing about Morrocanth, and what's difficult to get your head round, I think, particularly when you read the second edition rules, is that they keep people as herds, don't they? As animals. Yeah. They keep people as animals.
They lost a wager, didn't they? With the
It talks about this wager with the gods and all that kind of gland and stuff about the animals and the men, and the men lost the wager, didn't they, or something? Yeah. And so the Morrocanth are like people and the people are like animals. And what I think it makes very clear in Borderlands, which I don't think comes across in the second edition rules, is that the beast men or the herd men aren't people, aren't sentient people like normal people, are they?
No.
They are like animals. They have the mind of an animal, but they just have the body of a human, effectively, don't they?
Yeah.
And there is a spell, in the Games Master's Guide for Borderlands, where the Morrocanth can turn a person into a herd person, or they can grant intelligence to a herd person.
And I think when we encountered the Morrocanth, it was like the herd people were like meerkats coming out of the long grass.
Well, in Scouting the Land, you, as the title suggests, essentially it's a scenario of wandering around his lands.
Yeah,
having a look at things and just generally mapping it, sort of mapping it, looking at what he's got. And you do encounter Morrocanth, and there's a kind of dispute, isn't there, between the Agimori, who are a human barbarian tribe, and some Morrocanth who found Agimori sort of trying to free some of the herd people. You get involved in that way, in that dispute, don't you, about how to deal with it.
And what and why I think it embodies Glorantha is that there is a kind of relativism in place, so that there is no right or wrong answer to this. Whatever solution you come up with between the Agimori and the Morrocanth has consequences. Consequences on the rest of the campaign.
Yeah,
and. And I think it was at that point when, because we should say that we played it again, didn't we? We missed this.
Played it twice.
So we opened the box on it originally back in 1982, and we opened the box again on it in 2013, 30 years later, and to play it again as adults.
Yeah.
And I think it was at this point in Scouting the Land, because in the original, when I played it on that dining table and that fateful day, I rushed through this because I thought
it's boring,
yeah, it's all talking, this,
yeah,
I'm going, don't worry, you'll be able to kill something in a bit,
yeah,
and I kind of race you through it so you could see it. But I think we really enjoyed this scenario because it made us realise that, what if we're the bad guys in this?
Yes. I think that's one of the big problems with Borderlands, when you become an adult and you've grown up and you have
a post-colonial analysis.
Forgive us for saying, maybe a liberal elite view. But no, there is a sense of, you realise, and this becomes a problem much later on, a bigger problem later on, but you're right. I mean, you ran it originally and I ran it the second time. But you become very aware that you are working for the man, aren't you? You're working for the imperialist forces.
Imperial power, and in essence, you are a death squad.
Yes, you are a death squad.
Given license for genocide and ethnic cleansing.
Yes, that's essentially what it is. Essentially, it parallels kind of, I don't know, Native Americans or British imperialism. It parallels that idea that you've been given some land. You're an imperialist leader. You've been given some land, and the people in that land are not necessarily evil.
Yeah.
They just live there,
yes.
And they're a bit different from you. But get rid of them. Can you just get rid of them? And if any of them kick off or cause any problems, just kill them.
Yeah, you know, just...
And the encounter book is interesting as well on this level, because it gives you a little note for each encounter about what the Duke's view of these different tribes and races are. So that, you know, certain ones that you might encounter, the Duke just wants to get rid of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't care how you do it. Just get rid of them.
Yeah.
So if you kill them, don't matter.
Yeah.
And you're right. Very early on, even before you start doing any of that, it becomes very apparent as a man in the late 40s. You think, hang on a minute. Oh dear.
I mean, we still enjoyed it, but it was just a bit.
There was an uncomfortableness about.
Yeah.
And I'm sure as we discussed the other adventures, that will be a recurring theme.
Yeah. So Skates in the Land does give a flavour of what's going to come.
Mm.
And the second scenario, which is the outlaw hunt, is fairly lightweight, isn't it? It's just a case of getting rid of some duck bandits that have taken
raiding ships on the river, haven't they?
Yeah.
But immediately, I mean, obviously I wasn't a player, but I immediately liked the duck bandits. I mean, I would, wouldn't I? But I do like the duck bandits. I think they're colourful characters. It'd be more fun playing a duck bandit, you mean, wouldn't it?
And, of course, in the duck party, there's Pinfeather.
Yes.
Who appears in the original Apollo story. So
yeah.
It's quite good to have characters reoccurring.
It's a bit saucy as well, isn't it, this one?
Oh.
It's a bit rude, isn't it?
Oh, what?
Do you not remember that there's the ducks have been robbing ships and they've got loot? And this is no word of a lie. It says that they've managed to steal some, and in inverted commas it says, naughty toys
that
belong to the wife of the governor of Prax. And the ducks don't know what to do with the naughty toys, so they've just arranged them thinking that they're ornaments. Now, we find that funny now, but when we were 12, 13, I mean, Anne Summers didn't open in Bolton until the 90s. You know what they were talking about. Naughty toys, weren't they?
Naughty toys.
Yeah. Well, that's quite
Governor,
funny.
Governor of Prax is obviously away very often.
Yeah, he's a busy man, isn't he?
busy man.
But joking apart, I think that highlights one of the nice things about Borderlands, in that it's got lots of little details like that, that are funny, quirky details that you think, it does no relevance to anything, does it, that?
No.
But it sort of gives a bit of colour and a bit of vibrancy to the whole thing, that the wife of the governor of Prax has these things that they've stolen and they don't know what to do with them. It's just very funny and colourful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think Borderlands is shot through with that kind of thing, and it's very good.
I think the campaign really starts to get its get going with Jezera's Rescue, which is the next one, for a couple of reasons, because I think it introduces Jezera, who's the daughter of the Duke, and therefore it kind of introduces the idea that there are personalities and people in the fort for you to interact with.
Yes, yes.
And get close to the family and some of the happening. And even back in the day, even back when we were 12, we made a big play of that, didn't we? That kind of day-to-day experience. We actually lived it in real time, didn't we? Because you could back then, you know. It was like these tent poles of episodes were there, but we spent a lot of time just milling around the fort and encountering people and making enemies of people like Rattail Poison Knife those kind of other characters that they have in there. But Jezera is the daughter of the Duke, and she gets kidnapped, and it's an old fashioned rescue.
Yes.
And the second reason I think it's good, because I think it's a brilliantly designed dungeon. A brilliant design.
Big spoiler coming here.
Yeah.
Isn't there?
Yeah.
You're going to give this big spoiler away now?
Well, I think we should. Because
we've warned people, haven't we?
Yeah. Because it sets the tone, it sets the idea that this is a former, well, this is a temple to Vivermont. That this
yes,
is,
it sets up that well, in Scouting the Land, you pass this tower, don't you?
There's yeah.
rumours that a vampire used to live here, so it sets up the idea that there might be a vampire in here. It
yeah.
puts everyone on edge a little bit,
because yeah.
vampires in RuneQuest, vampires in any game, but particularly RuneQuest, particularly nasty kind of creatures, kind of, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, you kind of see shapes, bat-like shapes.
You do, wing shapes yeah,
coming over it. So, when you encounter it in Skating yeah. the Land. So you kind of, as a party of adventures, you're preparing,
yeah.
Sharpening stakes and yeah. doing that, all the usual things to go in there. And the reason why I think it's really well designed is that it's a tower that really you're forced into climbing up and coming down.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's a front door, but you can't get through that front door.
Well, you can't, because it's Tusk Riders, isn't it? And the,
yeah.
You can't get through the front door, and even if you do, there are horrible big Tusk
yeah.
beasts waiting to go you to death.
Yeah. there isn't a vampire in there, but
no.
The whole thing creates the idea that yeah. any moment around the corner, it's going to be
and
a
vampire. The winged creatures are gargoyles on the top,
yeah.
aren't they?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it does. It kind of sets you up. I think as well, what's good about Jezra's Rescue is that we talked about the kind of imperialist dimension of it, which is a bit tricky. But actually, Jezra's Rescue is the least like that, isn't it? Because
yes.
it is a rescue. It's a straightforward rescue. Young daughter, his teenage daughter, has been taken by Tusk Riders, and you've got to rescue her. That said, again, I think my perspective as a man in late middle age with a teenage daughter, I'd be inclined to let them keep her. I think when we were 13, we were very, very keen to rescue the beautiful 18-year-old Jezra. But as a 48-year-old man, I'm inclined to say, well, we can keep her. Well,
yeah.
just give them some money and say, don't hurt her, just keep her in there. I'm going on holiday for a couple of weeks. And when I get back, then we'll talk about a rescue mission, maybe. I think Ross of Rome's he wants her back immediately, doesn't he? Strange man.
Now this we talked about a step change, and then this is where the step change happens in
yeah.
Order of Toughness.
Yes.
So the fourth adventure is the Revenge of Muriah, which
yeah.
is Muriah is an old crone who's been wronged by the villagers,
yes. yeah.
And as a consequence, disease starts to infect the waters.
Yeah.
And the mercenaries have to travel upstream where they discover a brew nest. And it's kind of, the brews are pretty tough.
They are tough. I mean, you're talking, I think, some tough brews plus a rune priest and at least one rune lord. It's like 110%, you know, with a spear
so it's,
and spells coming out of their ears. I mean, you know, that's a Celtic feature, has spells coming out of ears.
30 years on, Blythe, I owe you an apology.
Right, yes. Keep recording. Go on. It's your rare moment.
Because you were put through the grinder, weren't you?
I was a bit, yes. I think... I was. I think I lost one character for every game in this. At least one. So
yeah.
I was essentially killed in every single adventure. But I would like to get on my high horse at this point.
The high horse?
I'd like to bring the high horse.
The horse? In. The horse?
I'd like to
bring it. We haven't seen the horse for a bit.
We haven't. I'd like to bring it in.
Come on in.
Come in, horse. Come in, Dobbin.
The high horse.
It has to be said, doesn't it? We played Borderlands with someone else, didn't we?
Yeah.
And he did very well in it.
He did. Dertram the Desperate. I think he survived the whole thing.
He survived the whole thing. Did very well. And after Borderlands, carried on playing him, and then we know. I noticed that during some spirit combat, at a vital moment, he didn't roll the right number and scooped the dice up and claimed to have rolled it. And I thought, oh dear, oh dear, have we been had here? Has somebody got through Borderlands by
cheating, essentially?
Yeah, That seems a terrible thing to say, but I think
because as you say, I was very, very much of the opinion that, you know, the fanboy to rune lord.
Yeah, we all were. I think that's how we played it. I think we got it into our heads. That's what you did. It seemed like the odd thing is, it seemed like cheating to bump your percentages up, didn't it? That seemed like cheating. So every character I created a basic character. And of course, I just created a basic character and then played them against a brew rune priest. And you know what? And this comes as a shock to everyone. I got killed. Because I had a scimitar at 25%.
Yeah.
And he had a bastard sword at 120%.
And some might say the bottom of the high horse, not the resourcefulness to cheat.
We didn't see it as a game, did we?
No.
We saw the game as a mechanism for telling stories. So it didn't seem a point to cheat it. It wasn't like a game you could win.
No, no.
But then it certainly felt like you'd lost when you got your head sliced off.
A lot. And I think that's why I think it's a foundational thing about how our approach to role-playing. Mm. It changed us as role-playing.
Yes, it did. It was very, very formative,
So Revenge of Muirai had a bit of a life of its own because scholars of RuneQuest will know that it went on to appear like an extension appeared in White Dwarf. Mm, and I think we covered this in the Old Scrolls episode way back when. So it kind of had a spin-off adventure. The next one was The Grinder. This is the centerpiece really of the whole campaign, which is Five Eyes Temple.
Yes.
So Five Eyes Temple is a site of religious significance
to an indigenous population.
To an indigenous
population. You have to go and kill and destroy them all.
And I suppose the joke or the kind of the game in this is that they're newtlings. So newtlings are childlike lizard type creatures. It's going to be a breeze. And Five Eyes Temple gets its name through the five eyes, which form
caves,
five caves.
Yeah,
right. So there's five ways into this place.
Yeah.
Each one as dangerous as the other.
Yes.
So in there you've got a manticore, you've got a dragon, you've got loads and loads of encounters to
To give an insight into how dangerous the five ways in are, I think there's one way in's not that dangerous and there's four that are dangerous. Of the four very, very dangerous ones, the one with the dragon in is the least dangerous.
Yes.
Which gives you some idea of how dangerous the other ones are, because you can negotiate with the dragon, Krang the dragon. You can negotiate with him, but you can't negotiate with any of the others. So, and one of them's actually a dead end.
Yes.
Isn't it? There's a troll tomb, isn't there?
Yeah, which
lots
is
of spirit combat and ghosts. It's really, really deadly. And it don't actually take you anywhere. You have to come out and think, oh, that was a dead end.
And although you said that the dragon one is one where you can negotiate your way through, it does take you almost through the back way, where you can get trapped by wardings.
And you
end up getting in, but you can't get out. It's a really tricky, dungeon. I can't remember particularly enjoying running it back then, but I enjoy playing it as a player. Back in 2014.
I didn't enjoy running it either. I think it's very difficult to run because there are some odd things in there that, you know, don't quite stack up, and you think, I don't know how these things are supposed to react. So it's like a living dungeon, isn't it? So it's a temple where these creatures live. So there's stuff in there that lives in there, it coexists with them. And there are some visiting dragon newts, aren't there? But it's difficult because you don't quite know how, and it doesn't quite tell you how things are going to react and to you being there. That's quite difficult. And also, one of the problems is just simply the maths involved, because the newtlings are quite puny. And by this point, you're quite tough because you've survived Bruges, you've survived the Tusk Riders. So the only way you can really make it threatening is by having lots of newtlings attacking you. But from a Games Master's perspective, that's really difficult to run, because you need 8, 9, 10, 12 newtlings, you know, and you think, oh God, you know. And it sort of brings out one of the flaws in the game system, that once you pile in too many monsters, it's really, really difficult. I remember going home one after we'd done part of it one night, my head was in bits. I'm thinking, oh God, you know, all these new twins that, you know, you're just worrying about your two characters. I'm worrying about 15 new twins in the room. It's very, very difficult because it doesn't have a kind of, you know, because it does the attack, parry, critical, fumble, strike, round, all those things going on. It is very difficult to manage mass combats. And it doesn't have any rules in second edition for a mob attack, does it?
No.
I know later editions of the mob and other games do it, but RuneQuest 2 don't do mob attacks. So it's very difficult to run from that perspective.
But it's a very flavourful dungeon. It's an old-fashioned dungeon, isn't it?
It is, yes.
And it's full of colour, and as you say, some of the items you find are very interesting.
The
encounters are interesting. And it puts you into tricky situations as a player, which are very enjoyable. Yeah. And it's a hard act to follow. And
yes.
I think this is where afterwards it kind of, the campaign starts to dissipate, doesn't it?
It does a bit, because
after that you're expected to climb up the Condor Crags, which are these huge monolithic outcrops where you have to climb to the top and recover the condor eggs whilst being attacked by condors.
We had a lot of fun doing that though.
We did.
It surprised me actually, because when, as you say, after Five Eyes Temple I was preparing Condor Crags, and I remember thinking, like I said, this is a bit of an anticlimax in a way, because you've had this big dungeon and all this fighting and a dragon and a manticore and all this stuff. But actually, we had a lot of fun with Condor Crags.
Yeah.
I think you and Eddie both said you really enjoyed it.
Yeah, we did. Know, yeah.
It's good, quite a good. Again, it's a little bit old school, isn't it? Climb up here, the big monsters. You know,
it's dangerous climbing.
Climbing's dangerous and exciting, and there's lots of dice rolls. Again, a thing that Borderlands does is it brings in climbing rules that are quite interesting and involve lots and lots of dice rolls. So there's that sense in which you get quite high up onto these crags to the point where if you fall off, you're a goner. There's no dice rolling involved. You're hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of feet up. But there's enough dice rolls to make it feel dangerous, but not stupidly deadly. So it's not like you fail your climb roll, you fall off and die.
Yeah.
You fail your climb roll, you do dexterity, you see if you can grab on, you see if you can do this. And so there's enough dice rolls between you and certain death to make it survivable, but also to make it quite exciting, because it does feel dangerous.
It was exciting.
Yeah, it replicates the idea of climbing quite well, I think.
Mm. The final one is into Giantlands, where the mercenaries have to, it's a cross-country adventure, isn't it?
You have to take the eggs from the Condor Crags to Gonorta, who's a giant who lives up in the north. And Gonorta's got a sword, which is a family heirloom. So they say he's a funny one, because it's a bit of an anticlimax, because it's difficult, because it's that difficulty that you get, the most difficult of adventures to run. The journey, the long journey, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you go on a long journey, you meet barbarians, you're supposed to kind of perhaps get lost, run out of food. And it all sounds very well, but it's difficult to run, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think I struggled to run it. I think you did back in the day. It was a difficult one to run.
I think we went through a number of horses as well, didn't we, in that campaign? It's in a lot of floodplain.
It's flooded rivers. You can. And it's tricky as well, because when you get to Gonorta, he gives you the sword. And the idea is that you take the sword back, so you do it all again to get the sword back. And again, he doesn't, you know.
Well, it leaves you to open up into campaign to big rubble. And
Griffin Mountain. So it does say some of the players might want to carry on into Griffin Mountain, Balazar, and up there.
So the sequel.
But in theory, the sword has to go back. So it's a tricky adventure to run. It's just. That thing, isn't it? It's always a problem, isn't it,
with
the idea. And I think what's telling is, nowadays when we run in a game, we will often do the kind of flash forward journey, won't we, where we'll say it's going to take 10 days over difficult terrain, and there's going to be a couple of encounters, which I'll just jump to the encounter. I'm not going to say first day keep watch, do this, second day keep watch at night, do this. But when we played it originally, that's the way we did it, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's quite difficult because it is a long journey. And I think when I ran it, it's a longer journey than I made out. I kind of cut it short in terms of days, but it is a very, very long journey, so it's difficult. The good thing about it is, though, there's a bit of the adventure where you do challenges, don't you, against barbarian tribes.
Yes. So
there's an oasis that you find, and to get the rights, because you're not a tribe, to get rights to use the oasis, the barbarians challenge you to a series of contests, and if you win the contest, they allow you to use the oasis. And I think they kick one of the tribes out, don't they?
Kick one
of the tribes out. But that's quite good.
Yeah.
But it takes a long time to get to that point, because you've got to travel all the way up there.
And I distinctly remember running that back in the day and having great fun with it, because by that time, although your character had gone through the grinder, your ultimate, I think your first ever Rune Lord.
Yes, the character went on to become a Rune Lord had been rolled, so I was all right then.
Yeah.
I was surviving things.
And you were enjoying it a lot more.
I was enjoying it more.
So when we started this off, I described this as like a key text, a key campaign for us. And the reason I said that is because I think it kind of defines our approach to story writing for games, in that it's mission based. So in there are plenty of missions.
Yes. Yeah. Keeps players focused.
Yeah. Go and do this.
Yes.
Go and do this. Yes. But there's plenty of scope for exploration as well, and sandbox, and you know, there's a few side quests that you can build into there, when that are built up through interaction with NPCs and characters. Mm. So I think it's got the best of both worlds, and I think that is what for me is lacking in some of the other stuff that I really enjoyed about this. And when I say that, that's why I negatively, well, I judge other campaigns and other material that was produced in the day negatively compared to this, because this gave me what I needed back then, and I'd say even 30 odd years now, this is exactly what I need. I need a context, a space to do something, but some good old-fashioned missions to accomplish.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think what it does, it straddles the kind of the old role-playing and new role-playing. So it is, as you said at the beginning, it's sort of forward-looking and backward-looking at the same time. So it positions, it's the early 80s. So, you know, role-playing is still in the realm of go down a dungeon, find this, find that. What Borderlands does, it has that. In the seven adventures, it has very old school missions. Go and do this, go and do that. Which is old fashioned, which is the old way, the way things were done then. But it's also looking forward, because it's giving you fully fleshed out NPCs with motivations, and it's giving you an area of land to explore where different things can happen. And that's very forward looking, isn't it? That's more in line with the things you find in RPG supplements and adventures nowadays, you
know? Yes.
So it's got the best of both worlds in a way. I think it was a criticism, though, is that it's only a minor criticism, but I think the missions are very much do or die, in that you have to complete them. So you have to kill all the brew, you have to rescue Jezra, you have to get rid, you have to clean out Five Eyes Temple, you have to do them. And in a way, that's not a criticism for it in the time it was written, but maybe nowadays.
I suppose it contradicts the idea that it's sandbox.
Yes, yeah it so, runs against it, because it straitjackets the players. I mean, as we were saying earlier, it is quite imperialistic. It is very much, there is an uncomfortableness to it, you know, in terms of what you're actually engaged in doing. And I think it would be very interesting to play it in a more open-ended way, where, you know, maybe you played someone else. Maybe you played the barbarians fighting against the Duke. But what I think,
or the Ducks as agent provocateurs.
Yes, you know, or the Neutlings or something. Yeah. But I suppose what I'm driving at is, because the missions are very much do or die, you have to be an Imperialist Death Squad.
Yes.
You've not much option though. You have to do that, because the minute you decide to make a pact with the Duck Outlaws or make a pact with the Neutlings, the whole thing goes out of kilter. And you could do that, but it would mean that you wouldn't do Condor Crags and you wouldn't do Into Giant Land because you've kind of taken a turn off the road. If you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Once you turn, if you turn against the Duke, it all falls apart. The whole missions fall apart.
There's a central assumption that you'll do his bidding.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's the central assumption. And whilst it's quite tempting because there's lots of other things going on, but it's almost like teasing you to get involved in. It's difficult to get too involved in them because you will have to go and do these things.
So these things come in 30-year cycles in for the armchair adventurers. Yes. So when we're in the retirement home, sat in a wing-backed armchair, on a dining table.
On a dining table.
Not our own, belonging to the care home. We'll be sat there and we'll be doing it again. Is that how we'll do it, do you think? Is that how we'll revisit Borderlands?
I don't know. I don't know. Like I said, if I was running it, I might say you're Newtlings.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, you could play Newtlings, actually, because the Duke does have some Newtlings who are on his side.
Yeah.
It's Stiff Tail.
Yes.
It's a Newtling. So you could play Newtlings and... You could kind of be double agents, couldn't you?
You could.
So you could do it that way, you know. You could be double agents for Five Eyes Temple.
The trouble is,
Ballspike!
Tales are so
difficult. Thank you very much to Rick for spending time in his busy schedule to do an interview. It was fantastic.
Okay, Blythe.
A personal highlight from
until next time,
my experience of podcasting so far. Thanks for that. The present looks great for Chaosium, for an amazing future based on the prodigious past. The first part of the episode generated lots of listener responses, such as this one from Mr. MJ Cookie. As a recent recruit, can I just offer thanks for a really entertaining pod? Love the RuneQuest discussion and the callback to Quincy Superhero Barbarian Duck, Master of Quack Fu. It fired a whole stream of memories from my early RPG days. RuneQuest was always our group's first go-to fantasy gaming, and we were terrible snobs about D&D. As for Glorantha, love it and hate it in equal measure, mostly for the same reason, detail. My biggest bugbear was that you'd be happily gaming for some fairly standard Tolkien-esque elves and dwarves, and then you'd buy the Elder Races supplement and learn that elves were walking, talking shrubs, and dwarves some hideous automata. The picture of elves in the second edition has much to answer for. Massive rewrites ensue. But on the other hand, I love Sun County, and I want to retire there. It's a good point, and what I've come to realise with Galantha, that it's best not to become overawed by its scale. I tend to introduce elements in stages rather than trying to do everything at once. Here's another that I received by Facebook. I never look at Facebook, so I caught it by chance. Just a note to say that I've been enjoying the Grognard Files. Excellent stuff. The zine was tremendous. Also pleased to hear that you'll be giving Call of Cthulhu 7th edition a go when you pick up the Fungi campaign again. If there's anything I can help with, please let me know. You've already had Rick on, so if you want the Cthulhu side of things, you know where I am. All the best. Cheers. Mike Mason. Thanks for that, Mike. It would be great to have you on talking about your experience from back in the day. I'll be in touch. Mike is a patron, and he's referring to the zine that we produced. The first issue is available as a PDF if you join the Patreon campaign. The podcast will always be free, but the tips that we receive via Patreon help cover the cost, help us to seek out material that we can include in future episodes, and it supports other projects. I've revamped the goals and changed the awards for the different pledge levels over the last couple of weeks. We're going to produce another fanzine in 2017, and a hard copy will be available for all patrons. So it's now better than ever to become an honorary member of the Armchair Adventurers Club. This month, Adam Alexander joined us at the $1 level. Welcome, Adam.
Steve Gonzalez has joined at the $5 level. So, as a thank you, I'm going to roll him something special from a table. This time, I'm reaching for the Luther Arkwright supplement for Mithras. It's full of atmosphere and great story hooks and loads of tables. So, Steve, I'm going to roll out and find out how you became an agent for Valhalla, moving across the parallels. Okay. 98. That's a high roll. So, it says here that you were originally being groomed unwittingly by the disruptors, and you were brought to Valhalla for safekeeping and operational duties. That explains a lot, Steve. Well, thank you for joining us. This is a final reminder that I'll be gamesmastering the Fire Opal of Set scenario at Convergence in Stockport using the Mithras Luther Arkwright rules. It takes place on the 18th of March 2017. So if you're listening to these as they're going out, there's still plenty of space available if you can get to Stockport at that time. I'll put a link in the show notes. Now, I'd like to tell you about what's featured in the next episode, but it says here that it's a top secret. So, I'll put my tux on and say, until next time, adios amigos.